Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. The American Veterinary Medical Association is located right here in Chicago, in Schaumburg specifically. And we're about to, and I have this opportunity frequently because the AVMA is in the Chicago area, to talk about this topic that is becoming a hot topic in veterinary medicine that I am certain that you care about, and that is the idea of a PA or physician's assistant occurring in veterinary medicine. We'll also talk about telehealth and how that is a wonderful idea, but, well, not always. And we'll explain what that's about as well. Dr. Gail Golab is here, Chief Veterinary Officer, as well as Executive Vice President of the American Veterinary Medical Association. Dr. Golab, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
All right. I'm good. A lot to talk about. So now you make an appointment. You call your doctor. This is a better example. You call your doctor. You say, achoo, achoo. I've got a cold, I think. I don't know. What do I do? And you get a call back, not from your doctor, but from your physician's assistant. And I think overall, I don't know really, but I think overall in human medicine, it's kind of worked out. Now, veterinary medicine, which works quite differently in some ways, quite similarly in other ways, wants to do the same. So first of all, am I setting this up correctly?
So, Steve, I think you have to be really careful when you're talking about comparing what the proposal is in veterinary medicine that is a mid-level practitioner, or what some are calling a veterinary professional associate, and physician's assistants or advanced practice registered nurses in human medicine, because they are not the same. Their duties are not the same, and they're not trained in the same way. So we really need to think about this mid-level professional proposal in veterinary medicine as a very unique thing for this particular field.
All right, so that's where we'll start. What is this proposal of a mid-level professional, as you said, in veterinary medicine?
So what we're talking about is an individual that, for the proponents of this proposal, would be practicing at the intersection of the veterinarian and the veterinary technician. But what would really happen is that the duties of this position would actually overlap those of the veterinarian and the veterinary technician, making this particular position redundant and unnecessary.
And also, so let's be a bit more specific about this. So you call your veterinarian because you think your dog is sneezing, or you know your dog is sneezing, and you're concerned. So it is this, in the future, potentially, mid-level professional that calls you back. But what's more, this mid-level professional is going to have some other duties. Explain what those other duties are.
So essentially, the VPA will be able to do most of what the veterinarian does. And so that includes diagnosing, recommending treatment plans for the animal, prognosing, and also doing surgery.
And the surgery?
And surgery.
Okay.
And the surgery part is actually quite scary, because they would be doing surgeries after having had less than a half of the comprehensive education that a veterinarian receives.
And in addition, would be doing some of the work that technicians currently do. So now the proponents of this say this is a good idea, I suspect, because we don't have enough veterinarians. We don't have enough veterinary technicians. And this provides opportunity for people to have their pets seen. Have I got that right?
So let's talk about the veterinary technician shortage first, because there's no question that we need more veterinary technicians. But ironically, creating a VPA could actually make that veterinary technician shortage worse, because the VPA would need those veterinary technicians just like the veterinarian needs those veterinary technicians. And when they're talking about veterinary shortages, we have to be very careful, because we don't really have a generalized shortage of veterinarians, but we have our gaps in certain areas. And so, for example, in emergency practice, in shelters, In rural areas, in some veterinary specialties. But as far as a general shortage, for example, of companion animal veterinarians, not so much, particularly considering that we have had a substantive increase in class sizes over the past several years, as well as many as 13 new veterinary schools that may be coming on board, and some of which will be graduating classes before 2030.
But right now, the wait in urban areas specifically, and I know in Chicago, can be more significant than what pet parents are accustomed to see their veterinarian. So sometimes they go online, and we'll talk about that later in the program as we talk about telehealth. However, that's kind of a reality for some people. So would this idea of this mid-level professional solve that problem?
And so the good news, Steve, is that some of the long wait times that we were experiencing as a result of pent-up demand after the pandemic have normalized at this point. And so the wait actually to get in, for example, emergency care and also for routine appointments has gone way, way down. An interesting thing about this particular position is that although it is proposed to be an individual who can diagnose, recommend a treatment plan, prognose, and do surgery, one thing that this particular individual could not do is to prescribe. And the reason they cannot prescribe is because that is limited to a veterinarian by federal law. So what that means is that if your animal needed a prescription, the only way that this particular individual, the VPA, could get that for you is if it was authorized by the veterinarian. And where this particularly becomes a little bit scary, so imagine that you, your pet is in the middle of a surgery, and your pet doesn't behave exactly the way that another kind of standard, if there is such a thing, pet would behave, and has an anesthetic issue. Because of federal law, that veterinary professional associate would not be able to prescribe a drug that was necessary to help that animal in the middle of the surgery. And in some cases, that veterinarian that is supervising that veterinary professional associate could be doing indirect supervision, meaning that that veterinarian would actually be off-site. That's part of our concern about this position, is it really hasn't been well thought out.
Another concern that I have is cost. The cost of veterinary medicine, which on one hand, I think is the best bargain in medicine. On the other, it still comes from your wallet, usually. Most people don't have pet insurance, whether they should or shouldn't. That's another conversation, but they don't. So how do you pay for the increasing cost? Will this increase your cost as a pet parent even more? We'll talk about that and more when we come back with Dr. Gail Golab of the American Veterinary Medical Association. Dr. Gail Golab is the Chief Veterinary Officer and Associate Executive Vice President of the American Veterinary Medical Association. And we're talking about what is interestingly enough, and I'm excited about it in one way, that it's on the ballot in Colorado, this notion of a mid-level professional. I want to get to that in a moment, Dr. Golab. First, I want to talk about what I teased before the break, and that would be the cost of veterinary medicine. It seems to me that if you have this mid-level, highly trained, efficiently trained, I'm not so sure about, but highly trained mid-level professional in veterinary medicine, more people working in the practice, if nothing else, someone's got to pay for that. It's usually the clients or the pet parents that are going to be paying. Does this, am I right about that? Someone's got to pay, I would think.
So I want to address two issues there, Steve. One of those is responding to the question you asked about cost. The other, though, is your comment about this particular individual being expertly trained. So in terms of the cost question, since you went there first, the idea behind this position that the proponents indicate is that it would be able to reduce labor costs and therefore it would be less expensive for veterinary services. I don't know how many people have ever seen a reduction in cost in a business actually be passed on to the customers, and in this case, the veterinary clients. That is highly unlikely. It's much more likely that those monetary savings would go back into the business itself. And so I think the expectation that a veterinary professional associate is going to reduce the cost of veterinary services is probably not realistic. In terms of the training of this particular individual, this is one of the areas we really have some severe concerns. And so basically what we're talking about is an individual that would complete a master's degree program. That's very different from a veterinarian who has a doctoral degree. And this master's degree program, the current draft of it, only includes 65 credit hours, which is about less than half of what a veterinarian would complete. And of those 65 credit hours, more than half of that, three semesters, is going to be delivered entirely online without any laboratories whatsoever. That online education would be followed by one in-person semester of minimal clinical training. So that is a semester where they would have to learn how to do physical exams, learn how to draw blood, learn how to do a diagnostic assessments, that kind of thing. And then that one brief semester of clinical training would then be followed by another very brief internship. So, and after completing that, that VPA is going to be expected to assess, diagnose, prognose, or recommend treatment for your animal. And that could potentially include performing complex surgeries for which they have not received adequate training. So again, this is not a situation like a physician's assistant or an advanced practice registered nurse. This is a mid-level that doesn't have sufficient training to do the job that they're intended to be able to do.
And if something happens, you mentioned this earlier briefly, but if something happens during surgery where even something simple like the anesthetic needs to be switched out now, right now. How does that work? Or even post-surgery, yes, the veterinarian can recommend whatever it is, but these things are sometimes very fluid, and maybe the pet isn't responding to this drug, whatever that is. Maybe there's a better choice. One of the concerns and reasons why this was brought up in the first place is veterinarians were hard to reach to get these sorts of things done as far as getting this new drug exchange, because my dog or cat isn't, or whatever the pet isn't doing great on it. And what I just said also, whatever the pet is. So veterinarians are trained to do more than dogs and cats. How would this person, you question, appropriately, I think, whether with this condensed education, this person would really have enough training to do everything veterinarians do on a daily basis. But they also do these things on a daily basis for more than dogs and cats. They oftentimes work on many different species. That's a lot of questions or comments all at once, Dr. Goleb.
Yeah, so it's interesting. This overlaps an issue that we were talking about earlier, right, which is the need for additional veterinary services in rural areas. The interesting thing about the draft curriculum for this particular position is that although it's been suggested that the VPA would help fill gaps in rural areas, the curriculum doesn't actually include much instruction beyond working with companion animals. And so that's a real concern, not only for the well-being of those particular animals, but because so many animals in rural areas are going to be horses, and they're going to be cattle, and they're going to be pigs, poultry, et cetera. A lot of those animals, not the horses, but the cows, pigs, and turkeys, chickens, are all part of our food supply, right? And so it's incredibly important that the individuals working with those animals be very well trained, because now we're not only talking about the health and welfare of that particular animal, but we're talking about the safety of our food supply and potential impacts on public health. And so to put an individual that's VPA into a rural area with insufficient training isn't only a risk for the animal's health and safety in that rural area, but it's also a risk for our food safety and our public health.
Okay, that's one thing that I mentioned. The other would be the fluidity of being able, you can't prescribe through this person. They're in the middle of doing surgery or even post-surgery. That is who you, as a pet parent, have contact with, perhaps. How does this benefit our pets? To me, there's a red flag.
Yeah, if your pet doesn't follow the protocol and that particular animal needs a drug, the only way that that VPA can get that drug for your animal is if that VPA can communicate with that veterinarian. And in an urgent situation, that communication has to be immediate. And again, like I indicated right now, the way that this VPA is being positioned, that supervision, so that involvement of the veterinarian can be indirect, which could mean that that veterinarian might not even be on the premises, might not even be in the hospital, along with that VPA at the time that the VPA is providing those services.
And what if the VPA cannot reach the veterinarian because it's maybe one veterinarian or two to choose from at that particular clinic, or reaches out to another veterinarian who has never even seen this pet before, but just has in his or her head a protocol, but not specifically to that pet? Is all of this somewhat concerning?
Well, it puts that VP in a very difficult position because they have to choose between the animal and violating federal law. In addition, I'm going to mention something about the relationship between this VPA and the veterinarian. So the way this is currently structured, the veterinarian will be liable for everything that that veterinary professional associate does and everything that veterinary professional associate should have done and didn't do. And so what this means is that the liability for veterinarians, for this veterinary professional associate, is a real concern. And because of that, there's not a lot of enthusiasm on the part of veterinarians for hiring this individual. They don't want to put your animal at risk, certainly. They also don't want to put their license at risk or their practice at risk as well. And so there's just a lot about this particular position that really hasn't been well thought out.
Well, and as I say, the cost of your veterinary medicine that, you know what, the reality is, and Dr. Golub, I don't know if you agree with me or not, but there's data to indicate how the cost of veterinary medicine has gone up beyond the cost of inflation for whatever a variety of reasons there might be. And now, potentially, one could be paying more, significantly more.
And so it's really, this has been a huge challenge for the veterinary profession. And so it's a combination of things, Steve, right? So our facility costs have gone up, the cost of drugs have gone up, the cost of diagnostic tests have gone up, our labor costs have gone up, just like everybody else has had. And so one of the challenges that we face, it's really different from human medicine, is that we don't have a pervasive third-party payer system, right? So we have some pet insurance, but that is not, there's so many pet owners that haven't taken advantage of that yet. And we don't have things like Medicare and Medicaid. And so when pet owners are presented with their bill, they're not used to seeing bills for medical services like what they see from their
All
veterinarian
right, hang
because
on,
they
hang
don't
on,
see
hang on,
those kinds of bills from their human healthcare
Yep,
provider, right?
Dr. Golub, I'm interrupting only because we have to break for time here, but I want to come back and continue this thought. I promise I will. We'll also talk about what's on the ballot box in Colorado, and who knows, could be here in Illinois, and we'll explain what that's about when we come back. Next week, Dr. Ernie Ward will be here. He is the founder of the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention. Why is this organization important? Well, it turns out 61% of cats are overweight or obese, and 59% of dogs are overweight or obese. Now, he'll be talking about why this might be so. We'll talk about also what might be done to solve this problem with your pet if you think your pet is overweight or obese. However, in the meantime, you can help. You can help the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention. Also, pet food companies, pharmaceutical companies, they look at all this data and want you to fill out a survey. It's a quick survey, whether you think your pet is overweight or not. It doesn't matter. Please participate. It will help veterinary medicine as a whole. AssociationForPetObesityPrevention.org, and you can fill out that quick survey. Dr. Gail Golub is the Chief Veterinary Officer and Associate Executive Vice President at the American Veterinary Medical Association, located in Schaumburg. You know what? We're talking about the cost at the moment of veterinary medicine, and we'll talk about how virtual or telehealth care ties into all that in a moment, Dr. Golub. So the reality is that the costs have gone up. Now, here's my position on it. It has gone up. I think as far as pet insurance is concerned, more people than ever before have more pets than ever before in their homes. And while they're through some companies as a nominal discount for multi-pet homes, you also have aging pets. So can you afford the pet insurance? I don't know. Some people I don't believe can, particularly if they have multiple pets. As pets age, the insurance costs go up. So we could talk about pet insurance, but that's a separate topic. The reality, as you mentioned, right, wrong, or otherwise, most people, although increasingly people do have it, but most people do not. Now, the cost of veterinary medicine has risen exceeding the cost of inflation. And you mentioned some of the reasons for that. But the reality is, it's gone up. Now, having said that, I would argue that veterinary medicine is actually a bargain for all, whether we're comparing it with dentistry, human medicine, ophthalmology, whatever it is, it actually is. Let's say a dog has cancer and a person has cancer. We share the same sorts of cancers, but also the same treatments for those cancers. Let's say there's surgery that's done. There's a protocol of chemotherapy that is done as well, and a couple of visits to either the veterinarian or, once you're out of the hospital, a couple of visits to a oncologist. In human medicine, the cost could be, Dr. Goleb, literally $1 million. I'm not joking. I mean, that literally could be the cost or more if we're talking about hospitalization, surgery, treatment, and drugs included, and visits to the doctor. In veterinary medicine, it might be, I don't know what it would be, depending on where you live, and but maybe $8,000, $10,000. That's nowhere near, if it's that much, and that's nowhere near the $1 million, but it's still coming out of your pocket. And to increase that cost even more, some people just say, or might just say, I can't do that. And that cost might be increased more when we're talking about the veterinary professional associate, this mid-level professional that we've been talking about. Can you comment on that?
So a couple of things, Steve. Number one, veterinarians try very hard to work with their clients, right, to make sure that we can come up with a treatment plan that works for their pet and works for them. And so there are a variety of options to try to manage the costs associated with this. But one of the challenges with the veterinary professional associate is you can run into situations, just because they haven't had as much training as a veterinarian, where there potentially could be mistakes that are going to be happening, misdiagnoses, treatment plans that aren't quite right, for what could be effective. And so there's always a potential in a situation like that, you may be looking at repeat veterinary visits because of that. And the more often you have to return to the veterinary hospital, of course, the more likely your costs are going to go up. And so making sure that you have an individual that is appropriately trained, that has the ability to examine your pet, has the knowledge base that's necessary to arrive at reasonable conclusions, et cetera, is incredibly important and goes a long way toward reducing the cost of providing veterinary services.
I agree with that, but it goes back to what Mike basically said earlier, that someone's got to pay for this additional salary at the practice. Also, they're taking, to me, away. So credentialed, this is an issue in veterinary medicine as well. We're kind of getting into the weeds here, but not really. That some practices don't have credentialed technicians even. And that credentialed technician has enormous training. And right now is the primary communicator, I'd argue, in veterinary medicine. Do we even need this position? And are we taking away from technicians and what technicians can do? And if you ask a technician about what the number one complaint, you have a job complaint, their number one complaint, I believe, is, I can't do enough. I can do more. I'm trained to do more. But for whatever the reason, I'm not doing more. Could we leverage, for lack of a better word, our technicians in a better way? And would we find more people going into school to be veterinary technicians? And should we?
That's an excellent point, Stephen. You're absolutely right. Rather than going down the path of creating a veterinary professional associate and mid-level practitioner, we definitely need to do a better job of using our veterinary technicians. They have tremendous skills, and we don't use them to the extent that we could. In addition to veterinary technicians, we also have individuals who are trained as veterinary technician specialists. So they have training that goes beyond the training of a typical veterinary technician in specialty areas like nutrition and dentistry and internal medicine, surgery, et cetera. So we have all kinds of opportunities to create better career paths for our veterinary technicians and use them more fully so that veterinarians can actually do what veterinarians need to do rather than doing the veterinary technician's job.
Excellent.
Much better alternative than the veterinary professional associate.
I love the way you put that. Now, here's what's exciting in a way. Colorado has put all this on the ballot. Should there be a veterinary professional associate? And can we have a school that allows it and then train these people and then create a position in Colorado for practices? Now, I'm excited because animals are on the ballot in a good way, but I am not sure this is a good idea, and I'm not sure we're having this conversation because I don't know that the public, hopefully now, you better understand it can make your choice, but I don't know that the public even knows about this issue. And the way it's worded on the ballot, it sounds like a good thing. Sure, I've got a dog, you know, and it's not a good thing, I don't think. And I know you agree, Dr. Golab. So can you comment about the fact that it's on the ballot?
So the reason that it's on the ballot in Colorado is not because the veterinary profession thought that it was a good idea. It is not because animal owners thought that it was a good idea. It's because there are some special interests out there that thought that it was a good idea. Some of those same special interests actually tried to use the legislative and regulatory process to make changes to state veterinary practice acts. But after a very comprehensive conversation in the Colorado State Legislature, including multiple meetings over a period of months with the various stakeholders, it was determined that a better approach to this was actually looking at two particular bills which passed in January, one addressing the utilization of veterinary technicians and encouraging the delegation of duties to those trained and registered, in this case, individuals, and a second one that dealt with providing clarity around the use of telehealth in Colorado. Unfortunately, this did not recommend, after all of that conversation, that you create a veterinary mid-level professional. And so the proponents were not satisfied with those efforts and kind of went around the bend and decided to create this ballot initiative. And so that's how we ended up with a ballot initiative in Colorado.
Yeah. So now you are, if you happen to be hearing this, the concern is that Illinois could be next, or eventually this can happen here if it passes in Colorado. It could get on the ballot here in Illinois, I suppose. So not a good idea. We both agree, Dr. Golab and I. And this all ties into what we're about to talk about, which is telehealth. And we will, when we come back, guaranteed, on WGN. Dr. Gail Golab is here. She's absolutely brilliant. She is the Chief Veterinary Officer, Associate Executive Vice President at the American Veterinary Medical Association. Dr. Golab, another topic which kind of ties in some ways with what we've been talking about is the use of telehealth. Now, during the pandemic, for our own health, we utilized telehealth in a way that previously wasn't. And the same goes for animal health. And laws were, for a time, veterinary practice acts in states said, okay, you can do whatever you want to do, essentially. However, in veterinary medicine, there is what is called a veterinary patient-client relationship. And it's there for a reason. Can you talk about what that is and why it's there?
Yeah, so Steve, the veterinary and client-patient relationship is essentially an agreement between the veterinarian and the client regarding the care for the patient. So it has several components. And so, for example, it means that the veterinarian has seen the patient and has agreed to take responsibility for the medical care of that patient. It means that the client has agreed to follow the veterinarian's recommendations. And in many cases, there is also a requirement that that veterinarian be available or find another veterinarian to be available to continue to provide care for that patient. And so one of the important pieces of the veterinarian-client-patient relationship is that the veterinarian has sufficient knowledge about that patient in order to render an accurate diagnosis and recommendations for treatment for that patient. And so obtaining that sufficient knowledge, one of the best ways that we do that is through a physical examination of the patient and an in-person meeting with that animal's caretaker or owner.
You know, I can't imagine. Okay, let's play make-believe here. I call you. I say, my dog is coughing. What's wrong? How in the world can you possibly diagnose that? And here's the thing. There are many companies out there that are providing a quote-unquote service. I'm not so sure it's a service. To pet parents, the veterinarian or technician on the other end of the call has never met you, the person on the other end of the call has no access whatsoever to records. You may or may not be able to recall that you've had this happen before, and this is what my veterinarian tried, and it did or did not work. That's something. But in addition to that, the veterinarian you're talking to might not be in your state, so if you want legal recourse of some kind for some reason, or even to reach out to this person again, you may not be able to do that through this provider and may even be out of the country. And one more thing on top of that, our pets can't help. Our pets don't talk. So they can't say, this is exactly how I'm feeling. And for that reason, there are guardrails placed on pediatricians in human medicine. Same exact reason. So can you talk about all of that, Dr. Golub? I know that's a lot.
Sure. So I think, you know, one of the important things to understand, and it actually goes into a lot of the points that you raised, is the importance of that in-person encounter between the veterinarian, the patient, and the client. So we gain more information from that encounter than we would from practically any other source of information. So, for example, when we do the physical exam of the pet, right, we're able to touch that pet. Sometimes we can smell things that, diseases and that kind of thing, have a unique odor. We see and are able to observe, for example, how that animal is moving, what the animal is doing, how the animal reacts when we touch it. But we not only learn about the patient, when we're doing that physical exam and having that in-person visit, we also learn a whole lot about the owner, right? We learn about what the relationship is of that owner to the patient. We learn how comfortable that owner is around the patient and how easily they are able to handle that patient, which can have a huge impact on what we're going to recommend for a treatment plan, right? Because if the animal can't pill the patient, that's something that we need to know when we're trying to develop that plan. So that in-person encounter is hugely important. The other thing is that physical exam is the best tool in our toolbox, and a really good physical exam can narrow things down sufficiently that it will narrow the range of diagnostic tests that we might have to run. And by doing that, we can also reduce costs for the client. So there's all kinds of reasons that you want that in-person visit before you're using other modalities to care for that patient, like the use of telemedicine.
And to be clear, you are not suggesting, okay, if you're my veterinarian, Dr. Golub, if I see you with our cat and 4 months later I've got a question, a problem, a concern, that telemedicine is not actually a great way to go because I have a relationship with you.
Exactly. And so after that in-person encounter, we now know you and we now know your pet. And particularly if we're talking about something like a chronic illness, Telemedicine is wonderful if you're dealing with chronic illnesses because we can help, we can use it to help follow the progression of the disease. Hopefully it's not progressing too quickly. But we can also learn a lot about how well the treatment is working. And if we find out, for example, that either that for whatever reason, the medication is not being administered or is not able to be administered, we can find that out more quickly so we can intervene earlier and save suffering for the animal and also frustration and potentially cost for the client.
And it's a way to get into the exam room, so to speak. I may be able to make an appointment more quickly using my computer at home. It's more convenient as well, or my phone. So there are lots of advantages for the client. There are also advantages for veterinarians that actually do this, which many, I believe, increasingly do, Dr. Golab.
Right. It allows you to increase the efficiencies of your clinic, right? And so, for example, you can do a telehealth visit for certain types of cases and that sort of thing as follow-up rather than having that individual in your exam room. You can actually also provide opportunities for remote workers and tremendous opportunities for the involvement of your veterinary technicians. And so providing opportunities for them to provide education. There are opportunities for them to interact with clients and to find additional information out about that patient and about that client. And so huge opportunities to not only improve care for the patient, but also improve the operation of the practice.
And despite efforts that I've made and many others have made, if I say the word cat, that's another explanation. So the cat has already seen you. The cat doesn't love it. The carrier comes out, the cat's ready to go to swim across the ocean to go to Europe. You know, anything but that carrier, right? Shouldn't be that way. That's a separate conversation, but it is that way in many cases. So here's another explanation, I think, Dr. Golab.
So, yeah, certainly there are some cases where it can actually be very helpful to observe the animal in the home. And so behavioral cases, for example, issues sometimes with cats with inappropriate elimination and that kind of thing. You can learn a lot about what the environment is of that animal as well as how it behaves in what would be considered a more typical environment for it. So there are definitely advantages to be able to use audiovisual tools in the assessment of that patient, but it's really, really important to make sure that you have a good handle on the needs of that patient before you go down the road of using telehealth and telemedicine.
Dr. Gail Golab, American Veterinary Medical Association, always educational to speak with you, avma.org, to learn more about everything we spoke about. Dr. Golab, thank you.
You're welcome, Stevie. Always good to speak with you.
What's up, Doc? I don't sound like Mel Blanc, do I? I really don't. But this is exciting news having to do with rabbits. Petco says they are no longer selling rabbits. Now, I'm a little concerned because in 1994, they said the same thing. In 2008, they said the same thing. But I think this time they're going to stick to it. So this is great news. Here's why. Petco, PetSmart, Pet Supplies Plus, they have never sold dogs or cats. Dogs or cats? No. They offer animals from local animal shelters, sometimes rescues, and that is great. However, rabbits, well, Petco sold them and sells them for years. And they are never from responsible breeders, ever. What's more, rabbits get so stressed so easily, especially when they're young. So you have these rabbits transported to pet stores and getting very sick even before they get there. This is a good move. Petco, thank you very much. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.